This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series. Here's your host, Philip Thomas.
Jordan Castelow is the founder of Vision Spring and the I Alliance. Jordan also founded SCOJO New York and the Global Health Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. Prior to his position at the Council, he served as director of the River Blindness Division at Helen Keller International. Jordan is a fellow of Draper Richards Kaplan, Skoll Ashoka, and is a Henry Crown Fellow at the Aspen Institute. He was named one of the Schwab Foundation's 2012 Social Entrepreneurs, was the inaugural winner of the John P. McNulty Prize, and was recently named to Forbes Impact 30. Vision Spring has been internationally recognized by the Skoll Foundation, the Aspen Institute, and the World Bank, is a three-time winner of Fast Company's Social Capitalist Award, and a winner of Duke University's Enterprising Social Innovation Award. Their mission is to ensure equitable and affordable glasses is available to every individual to live a productive life. Jordan Castelow, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Thank you, Philip. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So let me ask you the 60,000-foot question. What inspired you to found Vision Spring?
When I was a student studying optometry, I had an opportunity to join an organization that brought eye care to underserved populations in rural Mexico. And I met a 7-year-old boy who was from the School for the Blind. And upon examining his eyes, I realized with the help of my professor that he really wasn't blind. This boy just needed a super strong pair of eyeglasses. And when I put the glasses on his face for the first time, this blank stare of a blind child transformed into the most beautiful smile of joy that you could ever imagine. And it was a moment where I gave him his vision and he gave me mine. And I was reading some Mark Twain not too long ago and came across a quote that I think really encapsulates that moment. Mark Twain said that the two most important days of your life are the day that you're born and the day that you find out why. And for me, that was the day I found out why.
Now, that's a beautiful way to start it. You said you helped him with his vision and he helped you with yours. So tell us a bit about the vision of Vision Spring.
Well, the idea was quite simple. After returning to school and having seen thousands of people, I did a little research and realized that that boy was not alone. There are over 2.5 billion people in the world whose vision can be improved by a pair of eyeglasses who don't have them. And of those, over 600 million need glasses so strong that without them, they're categorized as visually impaired or blind. So that's 2 times the population of the United States of people who are visually impaired or blind, not because of some terrible eye disease, but just because they don't have access to a simple pair of eyeglasses, a technology that we all take for granted as yesterday's problem, and a technology that's been around for over 700 years. And I found that really unacceptable and wanted to do something about it.
Now, one of the things that Vision Spring is built on is a certain entrepreneurial model. And our listeners would love to hear more about it. But obviously, you went into this entrepreneurial model because I'm guessing you saw some shortcomings in the existing charity structure that, you know, kind of led you towards this model. So tell us a little bit about the model of Vision Spring and what were some of the shortcomings within the charity structure that you thought that your model would actually help overcome?
It's a great question, and you're correct. I did see some shortcomings, and that's what drove me to take a more social entrepreneurial approach to solving this huge market failure. The prevailing charity model that existed, in which I cut my teeth on, if you will, as a young student studying to be an eye doctor, was as follows. Well-meaning organizations would raise eyeglasses from people in the United States and Western Europe who had glasses and who were throwing them out because they were buying some new ones. And so they would recycle them, and then they would categorize them by strength. They would bring them down to foreign lands, and they would try to match them up with people who needed them. And it was all well-intended, but some research has recently shown that that model, the cost of delivering a pair of glasses in that model requires around $20 of philanthropic subsidy. Whereas last year at Vision Spring, where we provided about 1 million people with eyeglasses, our model required less than $3.50 of subsidy. So it was 6 times more efficient. But the moment that really put me on that course was a really interesting story that I'd love to tell your listeners if you would allow me to. So this was also as part, this was later on, this was the fourth or fifth trip that I took as a student with the same organization. And we found ourselves in the western state of Choco, Colombia, the poorest state of in Colombia, where the Choco Indians lived. And a couple of days into the clinic, I met a woman who was known as the blind lady in the village that she lived in. She had canoed a full day downriver because she heard that a team of American eye doctors were there to provide eye care services and dispense eyeglasses. And we examined her, and she couldn't see the big E on the eye chart. She had a very strong prescription. And like the boy, as soon as I put those glasses on, she could see for the first time in her life. She was in her 40s, and she required a -8 diopter prescription for your listeners who know their eyeglass or contact lens prescription. It's quite high. And we were very proud of ourselves, yet another person whose vision has been saved. We give ourselves some high fives and got back to work. A couple of days later, the same woman came back and through translation from her native Choco tongue to Spanish to English, we found out that when she returned to her village, people laughed at her so much that she wouldn't wear the glasses because she was ostracized. And when we looked at the glasses, we understood why. They were completely culturally inappropriate. She was dressed in traditional Choco Indian garb, but the only glasses that matched her very unusual prescription that we had was a pair of 1950 cat eye glasses with rhinestones, which would have gone over famously in the East Village. Or maybe Berlin, but didn't go over well in the Choco Indian community. And then she did something when we explained to her the situation, that this was the only pair that we had that matched her prescription. She did something that kind of shocked us all. She took the glasses off. She put them on a wooden table. She went back into her canoe, and she canoed upriver, preferring to be blind than be ostracized. And that was the moment where I said, okay, if someone's choosing blindness over what we're providing, we must be doing something wrong. And we needed to take a more customer-centric approach. We needed to have a market-based feedback loop that made it clear that the person that we were providing our product to wanted our product, valued our product, and our products were indeed aspirational for them.
Now, obviously, this meant a lot of adaptation. And it seems to me that there was a certain incarnational approach in the way you viewed your calling. Can you tell us a little bit about how that approach kind of evolved? And the reason I'm asking this is, you're right, you know, we live here in the United States, and quite often we see these bins where we can you know, put in our own old eyeglasses. Certain organizations pick them up and help others. And of course, I realize that this is not a comment on what they're doing. But how has this, a certain incarnational approach, evolved as you've continued to work with Vision Spring?
Well, I agree that because the problem is so huge, we don't want to in any way dissuade people who are working toward trying to solve the problem in whatever manner they are. I just chose, I felt that the long-term solution, because the problem was so huge, had to have a market-based component to it. We needed to stimulate a market mechanism. Because charity was just not up to the task in terms of the size of the problem. As I mentioned, 2.5 billion people. So we needed to get markets to work. And so A number of factors led me to that. The first was that moment in Choco where I saw that woman choosing blindness over our product. Another pivotal moment was when I was in Cameroon and I met a woman along the Sanaga River in Cameroon who I would ask, you know, what are your needs here? And I would ask that to people throughout the world. And it was always that same list of needs that I need better education for my children, better health care, better housing, better agricultural products, clean water. But she said something that really struck me. She said, you know, just that there's really one meta need. She didn't use the word meta, but she said that we have one primary need, which is opportunity. Because like you and your family, you want to be self-reliant and you want to be able to have the opportunity to support your children. And if you have opportunity, then you can give them education. You can give them health care. And so I saw that there were a lot of people who were needing opportunity. And then I also saw there were a lot of people who were losing opportunity because as they got into their middle age and their vision started to fail like it does in your 40s, it gets harder to see up close, people were falling out of the workforce. So the first model of Vision Spring was, well, why can't we just train local people, particularly women, to start small businesses, give them opportunity to sell a useful product and target people who needed those glasses to see so they could continue to work. And we called it our double whammies. We would create and sustain livelihoods through better vision.
Now, you know, throughout your some of the material that I've been reading up about you, you concentrate a lot on the bottom of the pyramid. How have you been able to keep your price point low for your on-the-ground entrepreneurs?
Well, the good news in that regard is that we were able to tap into the same supply chain that Walmart and Target and some of the biggest companies in the world were tapping into in regards to eyeglasses. So you've all seen the ready-made reading glasses at the corner pharmacy that cost $10 in America, $12, sometimes even less. We can access those glasses at less than a dollar. And we can then have efficient distribution channels that lead to people having to pay just a dollar to a dollar and a half, $2 for that simple product. And half of the people in the world who need eyeglasses just need those simple ready-made reading glasses. The other people who we also serve who need prescription glasses, whether they're adults or children in school, the glasses are a little more expensive, but not wildly so. Our average prescription glasses in India, for instance, cost about $4 to $5, which really is in the realm of possibility for even the poorest people on the planet who earn $1, $2, $3 a day. They have spending capacity. As you see, there are now, by the end of this year, there will be 5 billion individuals who have cell phones of one kind or other. And so these are the same people who have spending capacity for other products and services that are truly useful and pro-development.
Now, you've talked about how there is so much of work that you do with the entrepreneurs in developing nations. And, you know, many times one of the things that I've seen as a theme is sometimes it's related to glasses, but there's also a larger vision issue. What kind of training do you provide your on-the-ground entrepreneurs? You know, in America, we've gotten used to having, you know, an optometrist give, you know, more than just fix our glasses. They do give us advice. How are your entrepreneurs prepared to handle those issues that may be beyond the fix of eyeglasses? And what other support mechanisms do you have in place for them and their community?
Yes, that's very important, the whole continuity of care. As you say, in the United States, optometrists not only prescribe glasses and contact lenses, but they will diagnose and treat eye diseases. And if surgery is required, they will refer on to an ophthalmic surgeon. And that mechanism doesn't exist in most parts of the world. So what we always talk about, and this is true with a lot of public health initiatives, is how do you shift those tasks to lower trained, less expensive people? Because in some of the countries where we work, there's only one ophthalmologist per million people. Whereas in the United States, it's more like one optometrist or ophthalmologist per 10,000 people. And so how do you shift those tasks, the simplest tasks, to people who have less training, less cost, and who are less costly, but also not lose that continuity of care? So what we do is we train our vision entrepreneurs, as we call them, who are screening for presbyopia, screening for whether people need glasses or not, and we train them to determine who needs just the simple pair of glasses that they can take care of at the village level, and then if they just need that, sell them those. But if their vision falls outside of a certain bounds, then they're trained to refer to partner hospitals that tend to be socially based eye hospitals in the countries where we work, or to clinics that have a similar ethos to Vision Spring. So they're always connected to a downstream or upstream referral network.
So it seems like partnerships are very crucial to the success of Vision Spring. What are some of the challenges that you face in developing these collaborations and partnerships, and what do you typically look for in an ideal partner?
Partnerships are very crucial. When we first started, we were trying to create and manage everything. We had our own dedicated sales force. We would have to find the women, train the women. And what we realized was that was a slow slog to scaling. And about 3 or 4 years after we started, we came up with the idea of training other organizations that had similar missions of providing useful services to base of the pyramid consumers, and train those organizations to integrate vision services into their larger basket of goods. And one of our longstanding and best partners is BRAC, which is a Bangladeshi-based organization and now works worldwide. They are the largest NGO in the world. And actually, we were just in Bangladesh in February with them, celebrating our millionth customer served just in Bangladesh through our partnership with them. They have over 100,000 community health workers. We've trained about 25,000 of them to do vision screenings and sell eyeglasses. And what has the characteristics that we look for, first and foremost, is trust in the communities that they serve. So that's one of the key ingredients to doing any kind of health-related work at the base of the pyramid, is that the people that you're serving need to trust you. And the best way to gain trust is through organizations that have been embedded in those communities for decades, if not generations. And so we leverage off of that incredible trust. We also need organizations that have the capacity to move money, if you will, because that's also a significant skill. If money is going to flow, you want to make sure that it flows in a way that you're accountable and you can control that in a very real way. So we look for organizations that know how to sell things and move money. We also look for organizations that are aligned philosophically with the concept of social entrepreneurship, that even though people are poor, they should be paying for their products and services. They should be getting excellent products and services. Just because you're poor doesn't mean you deserve subpar products and services. And then organizations that also can learn with you and communicate openly and overcome challenges together.
Now, business, as we all know, requires capital. How are these businesses, these entrepreneurs, how are they capitalized? Is there a role of microfinance in Vision Spring's growth?
Historically, there used to be microcredit available, but we have different models now. I think it's also important to note that Vision Spring, since its inception, has done this vision entrepreneur model, and we continue to do it with BRAC and Vision for a Nation and other groups around the world. Vision for a Nation we do in Rwanda. But that's only one of our distribution models. We also have our own retail stores. We have about 10 retail stores in India. And then the largest part of our business over the last number of years has become our wholesale partnership channel, where we sell high-quality, low-cost eyeglasses to wholesale partners like eye hospitals, NGO groups, and even businesses that are interested in this area, like pharmacies and others. So we have both our vision entrepreneur model, our wholesale model, and our retail model, and each one is financed in a slightly different way. But capital is obviously critical to each of these channels of distribution.
Yeah, has the landscape changed a lot, or has it evolved since Vision Spring's inception? Do you see a larger marketplace for your local entrepreneurs? Other things that they could do to expand their business, realizing, of course, that especially in countries like India and other developing nations, the need for eyeglasses is such an unmet need. But is there a larger marketplace where your entrepreneurs could expand their business?
Yes, the market has changed in a number of very important ways over the last 15 years since we started. One of the critical ways is that global population is getting older, so more and more people need glasses. The number of children in school is growing, so more people need glasses to learn. There are additional players coming on board who are taking these social entrepreneurial models, both from the NGO community and from the private sector. The world's largest eyeglass lens manufacturer, Essilor, has joined the fight to broaden eyeglasses to the base of the pyramid through a number of really innovative programs. So the landscape has changed. And I mentioned earlier cell phones and smartphones, and that might be one of the biggest ways in that they've changed is that more and more people need glasses so they can see their smartphones, so they can do their mobile banking, so that they can check prices of agricultural products, so they can check the weather. And these phones, which used to be strictly auditory devices, are now visual because more and more people are getting the smartphones, so they need to see the screens. And even though all of the information of the world is a foot away from their eye, if the eye doesn't connect to the screen, the people don't get the benefit of that. And so we call it the last foot problem. And so we are seeing an uptake in eyeglass purchasing because of the increased use of smartphone technology.
This episode of Innovate is brought to you by Arch Street Press and Better to Speak of It, fostering relationships and results through creativity. Better to Speak of It focuses on core management and personal values in collaboration with Clive Gillinson, Executive and Artistic Director of Carnegie Hall. The book offers specific firsthand experiences from the leaders of key nonprofit, corporate, educational, and cultural institutions, including the Museum of Modern Art and the New York Public Library, as well as major performing artists such as Jesse Norman and Michael Tilson Thomas. Better to Speak of It, available now from Arch Street Press.
Shifting gears a bit, I remember reading that the founder of Warby Parker had worked with Vision Spring. And now, of course, from what I understand, you know, Warby Parker gives away a pair of glasses every time someone buys glasses from them. What is the future that you see in the growth of socially conscious businesses such as Warby Parker or Tom's? Do you think that there could be an intentional strategy spurred by organizations like yours to birth socially conscious businesses around the world?
Well, your facts are correct. The third employee of Vision Spring was Neil Blumenthal, who is one of the co-founders of Warby Parker. And Neil worked with Vision Spring for 5 years. He was a wonderful early member of our founding team. And then after spending 5 years with Vision Spring, he went back to business school. And what's interesting is most people who join Vision Spring in their 20s come here thinking they are going to study international affairs or social work or public health. And they almost always go back to business school because they see clearly through our example that business and the practice of business can be used as a force for good social change and good. And Neil was very much a believer of that. And then after launching Warby Parker, he created this one-for-one model because VisionSpring was in his DNA, and VisionSpring is the largest recipient of that, and Warby Parker has become VisionSpring's largest donor, which is a wonderful evolution and a wonderful part of our VisionSpring story, and we're very proud of that. And then in terms of, well, is this an example for other companies and the field at large, I think absolutely. But I do also think that in Neil's case and in Warby Parker's case, this is an example where the social good component of their business came from a really deep, authentic place because of Neil's experience. And I think consumers can kind of smell whether or not a social purpose vehicle of a business is really a marketing ploy or if it's truly core to the DNA of the business. So I think if you're going to get into business and have a social purpose, you really have to find a sweet spot and a calling of the kind of work that you support through that enterprise and make sure that it's coming from a deep and personal place.
Now, as VisionSpring grows and continues to serve more and more people around the globe, I'm sure you face some challenges, and some of those challenges around the area of sustainability. How has VisionSpring adapted to meet some of these needs of long-term sustainability in the world?
Yes, it is very important to both sustain programs and scale programs. And that's often one of the biggest challenges around starting a social enterprise. Our driving metric here is what we call PIP, which is philanthropic investment per pair. So how much philanthropic investment or philanthropic subsidies required to reach our target customer, which are basically people who have never had glasses before, new customers for eyeglasses. And what we like to do is to see that number go down over time. As I mentioned, in the charity model, that's about $20. And when we started in our first year, it was about $18. So we were a little bit better than the charity model, but not a whole lot. And then over the last decade plus, we've been increasingly scaling our business while driving down the subsidy per person reached. And last year, as I mentioned, it was about $3.50. And our ultimate objective is to get it as low as possible. But sometimes if you are a mission-based organization like ours and you're reaching out to the people who are at the very bottom of the economic pyramid, there are still sometimes a need for some subsidies. So what we like to do is see as little subsidy as necessary and think of the business as being as efficient as possible delivering the product and services that we do.
A couple more questions. I mean, obviously, VisionSpring is such an innovative idea, and I don't say that to flatter you, but just looking at what you've been able to achieve and the impact that you've had to that you've been able to have. But innovation is something that has to be continuous within an organization for an organization to stay relevant. How do you plan to keep VisionSpring innovative in the core of its DNA as you continue to meet the needs of people with vision problems?
Absolutely. Innovation is critical. And one of the keys toward innovation is understanding and being honest with what's working and what's not working. And what we try to do is be very honest with ourselves first and foremost, with our supporters as well. Are the activities that we're undertaking, are our business models truly getting and reaching the people that we're trying to reach in the most cost-effective way as possible? And if the answer in any way is no, then we try to innovate to increase the number of people we can serve, increase the efficiency by which we serve those people. And so a lot of innovation is in business model innovation around distribution, supply chain management, inventory, the same kinds of blocking and tackling that really any business needs to undertake. In addition to that, in a more common sense, when people think of innovation, they also think about technology. And we also are always looking and we're testing innovative technologies that can speed up the patient experience, improve the patient experience, make the ability to shift the task to less trained, less expensive people better and more accurate. So technology is going to play a very large role. There are already handheld devices that you can hold up to the eye, and within a few seconds, it can read what the prescription is and spit out a very useful prescription, or at least a starting place for a prescription. So there are some really exciting innovations in the horizon that we think will also be able to drive our impact and our efficiency.
How can people get involved with Vision Spring, and what are the kinds of people that you look for, you know, as you continue to grow Vision Spring?
Well, we do have internship opportunities. We do have job opportunities that come up occasionally as well, both here in the United States and our main office in India, where we hire even more people. And so check our website for those opportunities. And then in terms of involvement, I find that the old Nike saying, just do it. Just start getting involved with an issue area or an organization that inspires you. And you can do it by blogging about them and supporting them out in the ether, trying to get an internship with them, whether it's paid or unpaid. Some of our best employees started as interns and worked their way into the organization because they proved their value and their passion for the work that we do.
Jordan Castelow, it's been truly a pleasure and a privilege to speak with you and to hear about your work through Vision Spring. Thank you so much for giving us of your time at Innovate Podcast, and we and our listeners, thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.